This thing, do you realize what is
there is this thing,
do you realize
consciousness is affected,
there is this thing on, there is this thing going on,
what
do you realize
our consciousness is affected,
there is this thing going on,
what is called
the news I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is February 19th. My name is Sarah Jesmer, and I'm going to be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Gunnegahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. I'm speaking to you from Jaujage, or so-called Montreal. On the show today, we'll give you a roundup of the week's headlines and bring you news you can use. We'll be back in a minute.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada. CKUT.
But first, some news. Quebec is reporting 800 new cases of COVID-19 today, roughly 200 less than this time last week. The province announced Tuesday that movie theaters, sports arenas, pools will be partially reopening on February 26th in time for school spring break. Officials say these places will be open only to groups of two per household. And a storytelling project in the works for the past 5 years launched this week. The First People's Post-Secondary Storytelling Exchange is a network made up of Indigenous students hoping to improve education access and teaching processes, connect with each other about their academic experiences, and hone storytelling skills. There's 47 recommendations for the Montreal area post-secondary school system in their launch, which includes a call to increase Indigenous student support centers on campus, make some French language requirements optional, and hire more Indigenous people in places of leadership. And Montreal will vote in 3 days whether or not to support a call on the federal government to regularize status for migrants in Canada. That vote will be February 22nd. Canada's Border Service Agency reportedly confirmed pandemic-related deportations are suspended for now in Quebec. And a Terrebonne man, Leslie Blott, filed civil rights and police ethics complaints this week against two Sûreté du Québec officers for a December 2020 traffic stop. Blott alleges officers pulled him over with without reason, and that it's among a series of cases of racial profiling in the Lanadier region. He's being represented by the Center for Research Action on Race Relations. And CKUT host Miss Ben is continuing with special programming for Black History Month. Ben talks mental health this past week on Heal, Black Girl, Heal. You can tune into that show every Tuesday from 3 to 5 p.m. for the rest of the month.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited. and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Sarah Jesmer. Because of the pandemic, CKUT is operating remotely. That means that shows are a mix of podcasts, pre-recorded segments, and other relevant sounds. While we work to bring you new episodes of Off the Hour, we'll tune into a conversation today with author and activist Adrienne Marie Brown on the Final Straw Radio. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news you can use. See you then.
Airing first on Asheville FM, 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian podcast and broadcast emanating from occupied Soligi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from the long struggle towards liberation from around the world. Welcome. This week on The Final Straw, we feature a conversation between the occasional host Scott and Adrienne Marie Brown. She is the co-host of the How to Survive the End of the World and Octavia's Parables podcasts. For the hour, Scott and Adrienne speak about We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice, her latest booklet, available through AK Press.
Thank you for coming and talking to us in The Final Straw. Do you mind introducing yourself with your pronouns, any relevant information you want to give?
Yeah, so my name is Adrienne Marie Brown. I use she and they pronouns. I am a writer based in Detroit, and I am the author of Emergent Strategy, author of Pleasure Activism, co-editor of Octavia's Brood, and then most recently, and I think what we'll be talking about today, is the author of a booklet called We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice. I have been a movement facilitator and mediator for over 20 years now, close to 25 years something, and most of the writing and work that I do is rooted in the experiences and questions that have come from those places. So That's who I am for people who are meeting me here.
Thanks. I'm so excited to get to talk to you. And I wanted to dive into your most recent published book, because it offers a lot of good food for thought, especially for people who are engaged in different kinds of community processes and accountability and the larger projects of abolition and transformative justice.
Oh, one thing you should know, and it may show up for your listeners too, is I have neighbors upstairs, and today is the day that they host like the preschool pod. So if you hear like big thumps and bumps and things like that, it's just know that it's just like kids playing and everyone's all good. So
that's a good sound. I also have a sleeping cat who may awake and it's time to hang out on the computer.
Real life continues happening even during Zoom calls. So
so I kind of wanted to just like jump in with like right into the stuff, thinking that a lot of the listeners have a basic context for abolition and transformative justice. My first thing that I started thinking about in preparing to talk to you is that the way that cancel culture, which, you know, you refer to in the title, it's become kind of like a meme at this point. And I see... Like there's plenty of critiques from the radical liberatory side, which is the one that you're offering, but also like right-wing conservative perspectives. Like I'm thinking of like Trump getting kicked off Twitter, or like J.K. Rowling's transphobic stuff that like prompted this letter by all these rich and powerful people to like talk about cancel culture. So I was sort of wondering what you think, like how do we differentiate those critiques from the like liberatory side versus the powerful side?
I feel like I've had to explore this a lot more since the book came out than I ever did before. I really don't follow like what right-wing conservative people are up to or saying or doing. Like it's literally not a part of my world or my conversation. So when I wrote the initial piece and people were like, you know, Trump uses this language or whatever. And I was like, word? I don't follow him. So for me, there's been an interesting like, I can totally see the right wing using the critiques of cancel culture to dodge accountability. And to me, the major distinction is what is the impetus of the critique. For me, it's a love-based, abolition-based impetus, right? Which is like, I do believe that as people who are fighting for abolition, there are conversations we need to have, questions we need to be asking, and practices we need to get good at that are related to how do we practice being in deeper accountability with each other and starting to develop an expectation that accountability is possible when harm happens. Because I believe that those twin expectations are what lay the foundation for a truly post-prison, post-policing coexistence. So that to me feels like the primary thing is that when someone like a J.K. Rowling is being like, no, cancel culture is no good, what she's fundamentally fighting for is like, I want to protect my right to be oppressive. I want to protect my right to, you know, basically cancel or deny the existence of other people, right? And I'm like, what I think we are fighting for is the right to protect as many people as we can from being harmed, from being denied, from being erased. So there's a call, you know, to me, it's the difference. Also, people talk about call out versus call in, those kind of things. I think that a lot of what we're doing is like, we want to actually pull ourselves into more interdependence, more relationality, more accountability. And that feels like a huge distinction.
That's a good point too. Like, cause the words, they can become slippery, especially as they get co-opted by, you know, people who don't have those horizons that we have.
Yeah. And we have to, you know, we're always trying to figure out like, which words are we going to fight for and how do we do that fighting for? And it's hard, but I do think it's worth it in some places. It's like abolition is actually still ours. Transformative justice is still ours. And I don't think cancel culture necessarily is one that's ours. You know, for me, like, we will not cancel us. It's really about the activity of, it's like, we're not going to cancel the people that we need to be accountable for. How do we do that? You know?
Yeah, no, that's a really important distinction, because cancel culture is already the like mainstream critique of this thing. Is like, probably they see it as like a youth phenomenon or whatever on social media. And canceling is a thing that people do, but it's not a whole culture necessarily.
It's not. And it's also, I think the thing that's interesting is like, there's a culture of disposability and there's a culture of conflict avoidance. But I think the cancellation, I think so much of it is rooted in like social media culture.
Yeah.
So social media culture is like shallow engagement, you know, clickbait headlines, very surface level arguments, and then canceling people, right? It all goes together. It's like trolls gone wild. And then we're trying to build movement. And how do we navigate and organize around social media as a part of building movement? And how do we harness it as a tool? And I think what's been happening is it's been harnessing us, right? It's been like, we've gotten drawn into the way social media works as if that's how community works, or that's how community changes.
Yeah, there's like two different levels, like where we could use the social media as a tool for things that we've done historically to protect ourselves. But then there's this other level where it takes on another
sort of meaning.
And I guess like one thing I was thinking about reading your book is like, so like, you know, the probably also the most notable mainstream version of this that gets discussed is like hashtag Me Too. Mm-hmm. And it gets called a movement, but like, you know, from the sort of way that you discuss things in your book, I don't think it see it as a movement because it's isolated acts of naming something, right? Because it's not necessarily like a struggle in the streets. And I'm not saying that as a judgment that it, I am like reserving judgment of like it's effective or like should people do this, but I'd sort of be interested in thinking in about like that as like not having basis in this in a tangible community.
I mean, I think that it's interesting. I think it depends on like where and when you enter the Me Too conversation, right? So like, I think if people enter the conversation as like, this happened related to like Harvey Weinstein a year and a half, 2 years ago now, then I think that's the case. But I think if you take it all the way back to the work that Tarana Burke has been doing for years, that was very tangible. And the work that she has continued to do is like very much tangible, happening in real time, in real space, in real relationships, and calling for changes that happen in the offline world. And then using social media to help push that along or to spread that. But I just did an event with them recently, and I was blown away by how much they're inviting people into offline practices. Mm. And I think movement is kind of a slippery or tricky term, right? So I think it's not one of the things, like I see people all the time, like we're starting a movement. And I'm like, I don't think that's how movement works. I think things take off or people feel called into something. And then it's like, what's actually moving? And I look at like, is policy moving? Is our sense of identity moving? Is our sense of capacity moving? And in that sense, I would say that to me too is absolutely a movement because it has moved and transformed how people negotiate intimate relationship, how people negotiate intimate harm, and how people negotiate being public or not public about the harms that happen to them.
Right? Yeah.
So for me, I would see it that way.
Yeah, I like that idea. I was like thinking sort of like, you know, I don't know, like bell hooks kind of distinguishes between like a political representation and like pop culture that doesn't get grounded in grassroots. And I was thinking, but I think the way that you mentioned it actually makes sense. And it's like the thing I admire about the call outs that happen, because like, though we could read Me Too from a lens of like canceling or even like a carceral sort of mindset, it also is demanding accountability and is giving voice to people.
Absolutely. And like, that's where I think it's also interesting. Like, who do we listen to? So if you listen to Sharana and Nikita and so many people who are now working in that space, one of the things they talk about all the time is this is actually not about destruction, right? This is not about trying to bring people down or destroy people. We're trying to heal trauma. We're trying to end cycles of harm and heal the trauma that has come from that harm. And I think this is one of the most interesting pieces about the distinction between what I was actually initially writing about and the like larger culture of like cancellation and call out, because, you know, call outs are rooted in the communities I come from, Black and brown, queer, trans communities. And the reason that we needed the strategy initially was because the power differentials between us and the folks who were causing harm were so vast that we couldn't be heard as equal parts of the storytelling. We couldn't be heard as in our survival. And that's still the case in so many scenarios where, oh, these workers need to call someone out because, or call out an institution or call out a corporate entity because the power dynamics are so vast. And with a Harvey Weinstein, with an R. Kelly, with some of these big public cases, I'm like, I 100% support those. I have tweeted them. I'm like, those make sense to me because the power differentials are so big that the only way to potentially stop this harm is by making this huge call. I think the difference is then how do we handle it when the harm is much more horizontal, when it's in community, where there might be slightly more positional power, or slightly more social media cachet or something, but no one is wealthy. No one actually owns anything. No one has a longstanding security in any kind of way. And a lot of times we're talking about survivors where every, you know, in the situation where like everyone in the situation is a survivor of something. And that to me is where it starts to all get much more complex. And again, that still doesn't mean we take it off the table, right? It might still need to be, you know, I've supported situations where I was like, we have tried a million other things to get this person to stop causing harm, and this is now the move. And I think that's the case. So a lot of the pushback I got from people when I published the original essay was like, hold on. In a lot of these cases, like, we have tried everything. And like, you know, don't take the power out of the move that we do need the capacity to make. And that was definitely not my intention in writing it. It's not my intention now. It's to say, how do we make sure that we're using the tactic precisely when it needs to be used? And then how do we make sure we have other options when we need other options, right? That this is not the first thing people jump to, right?
Go to. Yeah. And I guess like that's the thing with like social media is that you see so many examples of it that, especially because like being harmed is a really isolating experience. And being able to voice it is really scary. And
it's so hard.
See the representation of that on social media that can give you like the ability to do something, even if you wouldn't like reach out to like your pod or whatever. Like that's a distinction that, I don't know, I kind of got lost where I was saying, but like,
Well, just briefly on that point, that's also part of what I'm fighting for. Like, as someone who is a survivor myself and who has really had to battle, like, would taking this public be something that was really healing for me? Who would I share this with that would be really healing for me? How would I actually be able to heal the pattern that happened here? What do I want for the person who has caused, you know, multiple people in my life who have caused harm? And that's very intimate reckoning. Yeah. I can't outsource, like, here's what I landed on, and that's what everyone else has got to do too.
Yeah.
Like, it's very intimate. But what I do know is I want the results to be satisfying, right? Like, if the person, if people are taking this huge risk to tell these stories, I want them to be satisfied that they then are able to get justice and that they're able to get healing. And I think that often isn't what happens with the way the call-outs play out right now. I think a lot of what happens is people take this huge risk, they tell a story, and now they're associated with that story, right? It's now they become a public face of like the worst thing that ever happened to them. Yeah. And sometimes there's some accountability. Often there's not. Sometimes the person who caused them harm just disappears and goes somewhere else and keeps causing harm. Yeah. And so I think for me, I'm just like, well, hold on, let's examine this strategy and figure out how do we actually make sure survivors are having a satisfying experience of healing and being held and getting room to process and not have to be responsible for managing anything to do with the person who caused them harm, right? Like I want us, I mean, my vision is where we live inside of communities that have the capacity and the skill to be like, that harm happened to you. We are flanking you. We've got you. You are being held. We are attending to your healing. And that there's also enough community to go to the person who caused that harm and be like, we are also going to hold you in a process of accountability and also healing, right? Because fundamentally, we know something's wrong if someone is causing that kind of harm. If someone commits sexual assault, if someone commits rape, if someone steals resources, if someone is abusing power, we know actually that there's some healing is also needed there. Not that the survivor needs to guide that healing, but the community does need to be responsible for. And I think we're a long way from that. But I'm like, that's, I think, where we need to be heading if we call ourselves abolitionists, is like, we have to develop the capacity to hold all of that in community so that we're not outsourcing it to a prison,
right?
To the police, right?
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're listening to Scott's conversation with Adrienne Marie Brown about We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice, recently published through AK Press. More of Adrienne's writing can be found at adriennemariebrown.net.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, because in this, like, transitional period, let's say, like, where we're not there in that vision that you just discussed, but we're, like, you know, trying to reach that, there's, like, that experience that so many people have, and you've probably seen this and had it yourself, like where accountability processes go wrong, or like a call out isolates someone and they get the person who gets harmed gets scrutinized and the process doesn't happen, or even like I feel like processes can be used to wield power within subcultural communities, like whether it's anarchist or like queer, and exclude people. So then there's like a high level, I feel, of burnout or like disillusionment with these processes. And I just wonder what you think about
How
we counteract that, because that's another form of healing that's needed, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I keep pointing people to these two resources that I'm like, they just came out last year, which to me says so much, right? About how early we are in the transformative justice experiment. And to place ourselves in the context of time, to me, that helps me like drop my shoulders and be like, of course we don't know what the fuck we're doing. And like these processes are fucking up and everything, because like we are so early and we have been, you know, and Miriam Kaba talks about this, that we have had 250 years of the carceral experiment of like well-funded policing and prison systems rooted in enslavement practices. Like we've had a long time of those being well-funded. And we have never had a period of experimentation where what we're talking about, transformative justice and abolition processes, have been well-funded, right? So of course, we're not resourced to do it. We haven't. So one book is Beyond Survival, that Ajiris Dixon and Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samar Sinha put out, which gives a history of transformative justice, which talks about the people who were doing it before they knew that they were doing it, or maybe they didn't call it that, but just different kind of case studies and models and experiments. So people can kind of see like, yeah, like we've been innovating and adapting and trying to figure this out. So that feels like one resource for people is like, go look at, like, we're not the first people to fuck up. you know, we still don't quite know how to hold these. We're learning. And then the other resource is Miriam Kaba and Shira Hassan put out this workbook called Fumbling Towards Repair. And I am in love with this workbook because it's very tangible as a resource. It's like, here's how you can do in a community accountability process in your community when something happens. And it's rooted in the idea that Miriam talks about, which is, it's not going to be a one-to-one shift from like the carceral state to a perfect transformative justice, like, you know, system that someone else still holds outside of us. It's going to be a system where we want to defund the police and defund the state and redistribute resources into a million different options in our community, including that many of us muscle up our capacity to do community accountability processes. And, you know, if we're doing one for the first time, I remember the first time I did one, I went in with a big dream of like healing, and I came out with like a mid-level satisfying, like I said my piece and that person agreed not to do whatever. So, you know, I just think it's important to be humble in a grand scale about the fact that like we are still learning these things. And there's a lot of people in our community who actually are developing some expertise around this, but you're developing expertise around something that is very often a private process. So it's not something that you're running out like, honey, let me tell you what I just did with this horrific person or whatever. Like it's very, a lot of it is very private and very quiet. And I think that also skews the sense of this moment because, you know, a lot of times the initial call outs or initial accountability moves are much more public and social media takes them very far, but then we don't see what happens behind the scenes. We don't see what was happening behind the scenes to lead up to that moment. All of those things are kind of behind. So I just think if we're able to be like, huh, we don't know how to do this yet. We have to learn how to do this. And we're going to, learning happens mostly through failure, right? Like we learn by trying something, it doesn't quite work, then we make the adjustment. We have so much to learn, right? We have to learn what roles work best for different people. Who are the mediators? Who are the people who can hold these processes? Who are the people who are like, I'm a healer, I can hold a role in the community? Do you have to experience these accountability processes yourself? Can you just read about it and hold it? Like there's so much to figure out. And to me, it's actually exciting, right? It's like we're in an exciting place potentially for transformative justice and abolition, but not if we stay committed to outsourcing those we deem as like bad or the processes themselves. It's more like, how do we turn and be like, yeah, we don't know how to do this. Let's learn.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, I had the opportunity to teach a queering transformative justice class that was like, that was cool. That was like pretty well funded. And it was right when those books came out. I was like so excited. I'm like, look, all these new books that are out on this. And
yes,
teaching that stuff to young people, which seems important, who maybe encountered it. But then like, and like, so like familiarizing them also with the like fact that it's not a one-to-one replacement or solution.
Yes.
I like also like, I use a lot Walida and Marisha's Angels with Dirty Faces because she talks about it not being like a resolution like we're used to within a capitalist society.
Exactly. And like looking at those three stories to, because I think that's the stuff is like looking at these different real life scenarios and being with the complexity of each of these human beings. I think that that's such a great book. I also point people a lot towards Mia Mingus's work, particularly the work around apology, because so much of it is like, you know, you're trying to get water out of a stone or whatever it feels like when you're like, what I really need is an acknowledgement of the harm you did, an apology for that. And so few people know how to give a good apology. And so then it's like there's just a myriad of resources like that, that I think we're building and generating and slowly bringing into relationship with each other, I think in 10 years, it's going to look very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Though there's something interesting. So I was starting to think about, like, so, you know, you talked about like the privacy or the intimacy of the situations that need this kind of handling. And then if we started like, you know, having people specializing and training in this stuff that go around doing the work, they, then there's like, I don't know, we could run the risk of like professionalizing it, which
I mean, that's, I hope that that's not the, you know, like to me, that's why the workbook model is so exciting. Like, and I say this as someone who has worked as a facilitator.
Yeah.
For the last, you know, 20 years. Right. So I recognize what happened for me was I had this skill that was of use to my community. And then it became a professionalized skill where suddenly people are like, we'll fly you to all these different places to do this. And for a while that really worked for me. It allowed me to work with very exciting movements, but it also has the impact in the long run of making people think they need to fly me in rather than looking around at like who in their community has this capacity and this strength. So, yeah. You know, I wrote Emergent Strategy to help with like spreading those tools. And I have a book coming out this spring called Holding Change, The Way of Emergent Strategy Facilitation and Mediation. And for me, the idea is like, similarly to the workbook is like, pick this up, integrate the skill set, you know, find the facilitators, find the people who are like this in your community who do mediation, who are drawn to it. And let's start to actually have more of a capacity for local reliance in these different systems and in these different needs. Like, I actually think the professionalization and the sense of like, we need to bring someone from afar to do this weakens what's possible at the level of the community.
Right. I know since you're like pull so much from Octavia Butler, that made me think about like kind of seeding these like communities that then figure it out themselves. Like
exactly.
And you know, like thinking about Emergent Strategy, and then you know, with the new book that you just mentioned, and so like one thing in okay, and We Will Not Cancel Us. You talk about the sort of like supremacy that we bear within us, and I and connect that kind of to like the diagnosis Wangkali make. In Octavia Butler's book about like the problem with humans is like
that hierarchy and intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like I see that work that you do, those that writing that you do as like part of the process, the internal process that we need to do to unlearn the supremacy or the hierarchy. Yes. And that would work for like on so many different levels of like power, like I don't know, like masculinity and all these
everything.
Things. So yeah, I guess like let me frame my question. I had written something. It's like, do you see this as a struggle that takes place in culture? Is it like internal? I mean, I think
you're
initiating this kind of new genre too of like a anti-authoritarian, like help book or something. That, like,
Thank you. You know, the other day I was doing an interview and they said that my new genre was facilla writing. Like writing stuff that facilitates people through a process. So I'll accept this too, anti-authoritarian help books. I do think it's something that happens at both end. And I'll say this, like one of my great teachers, mentors was Grace Lee Boggs, who is an Asian American freedom fighter based here in Detroit, part of the Black Power movement. Yeah. And she said, we must transform ourselves to transform the world. And when I first heard that, I was like, no, we have to go out and transform all the fucked up people who are doing bad things. Like, we're good. And it took me such a long time to understand what she meant, which is any of these systems that we are swimming in have also rooted inside of us. And as we uproot them, unlearn things inside of us, then we can become both models for what it looks like to be post-capitalist, post-nationalist, post-patriarchal, you know, post-white supremacy. We become models of that, we become practitioners of that, and we become scholars. Like, we actually understand what does it take to do that unlearning, right? Yeah. And that feels like such a crucial part of this. And in We Will Not Cancel Us, I reference my friend Prentice Hemphill's essay, Letting Go of Innocence, because that feels connected to this. It's like, first we have to recognize we are not above the people who have caused harm. Yeah. We may have had different circumstances that have led us to moving our harm in different ways or processing our trauma in different ways, I think is such a blessing. You know, I have a life of trauma, but early in my life, I was given tools around therapy. I was given tools around healers. I had a loving household, so a loving jumping off board from which to process the trauma of being alive in this time, which I think everyone actually is experiencing at some level. Different people, you know, I interact with people regularly. I'm like, they didn't come across the idea of therapy, or they were told that's not an option, or healer, that's private. That's something you don't do. And I'm like, that energy is going to move somewhere. So I don't look at myself as above anyone who ends up in the prison system or anyone who ends up canceled or anyone, you know, like, I'm just like, I just had different circumstances and they allowed me to process the trauma in different ways. That's internal work. That allows me to be present with the fact that capitalism is in me, petty, jealous behavior is in me, judgmental behavior is in me. And then I have to examine, like, where does white supremacy, where does patriarchy, where do those things live in me? I keep uprooting that. At the same time, I do believe it is cultural work. And that's why I write books as opposed to just having these thoughts in my head or only doing the work with a small group of friends, as I am interested in like dropping seeds into the culture to see if other things can bloom. And my experiment with that with Emergent Strategy felt so exciting to me because I released a book, didn't really promote it at all. I was just like, look, if there's other people hungry for these ideas, this will spread. And if they're not, then I'll just know that like I'm alone in Detroit looking at ants and that's fine. Like I felt kind of okay either way because the earth is still offering its amazing lessons regardless if people see it through my book or not. But now I know that that strategy can really work and We Will Not Cancel Us. Similarly, we did a couple of events that just felt like important conversations to have with Charlene Carruthers, with Cindy Wisner, with Shira Hassan, and with Malkia Devich Cyril, who wrote the afterword. But mostly it's just been like the book is out and people are either reading it or not. And I have a lot of people who are like, I'm reading this. And I've gotten a lot of messages from people who are like, I'm really surprised, like based on the first essay to like what happened in the book. I'm surprised. I see what you did. I see the growth. I see there's still, it's not like a perfect book. You know, it was a quick process, but to me, it feels important that people are reading it in their own groups and thinking about their own local culture, right? Because the social media world is not the whole world. It matters so much what's happening in our local movement circles and how at a local level we're integrating these questions of like, well, how do we handle harm? How do we handle conflict when it arises? Like, what are our case studies? Are there people who we have canceled or tried to dispose of, and what happened with them, right? Like, where are they now? Did they stop causing harm? Did that work? If not, what else could work? Are we putting people in the line of the state or in the eyes of the state? Just having that as a local conversation. The thing I'm interested in is a culture of discernment, a culture of mature conflict, generative conflict. And I think that's so important on this journey towards an abolitionist future. Is it's not just a policy change that will make that possible. It has to be an entire cultural shift, and cultural shifts because lots of individuals shift.
Right?
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
Silver Threads, Still Walking, Still Waking is co-hosted by me, Carla Bergman.
And me, Eleanor Goldfield. This is where we interview long-term organizers and radicals about their watershed moments, what they've learned along the way, and how they maintain their hope on this path, dreaming and building emergent worlds for a present and future anchored in justice and freedom for all.
Because there are forks in the road, but they all lead us home to the fight, to the build.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're listening to Scott's conversation with Adrienne Marie Brown about We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice, recently published through AK Press. More of Adrienne's writing can be found at adriennemariebrown.net.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking, because like the internal work, we're like sort of taught to think of the internal work as like the work you do for yourself and like your goals and your profession. But actually the internal work in this stuff, it turns you into the potential facilitator. Like I know, I mean, I'm not perfect, obviously, but I've done a lot of work, and the work that I do allows me to enter situations with like different, from a different place that I can help facilitate. Yeah. It's not because I'm better to like be above them or like avoid them completely, because that's impossible.
Yes, right. And I think right now the culture that is being produced is one where people have a lot of fear around making mistakes, which then limits how honest people are, because if we're being honest, we're making mistakes all the time and we have fucked up thoughts all the time. And one of the things I've always appreciated, you know, about my best friendships is that I could say something that is like wild, and then my friend will be like, that's wild, girl. Like, you can't say that, you know, or like, you, and let's examine where that thought came from. I'm like, I grew up in a military household. I grew up in a capitalist family. I grew up in, you know, I'm like, oh, I have to know that that shaped me, that by the time I went to an Ivy League university, like all those things shaped me. And so as I'm unlearning, there's a lot to unpack there. And if I'm above that unpacking, or if I'm hiding from ever making a mistake, then I can't do that learning. But we want to move from a culture where people are terrified to show up to a culture where people are excited to be able to be like, here's all of me. And I know I have work to do. And if it's a culture of belonging, right, where it's like, even if you're fucked up, which you definitely are, you still belong to the species and you can still belong to your community. And belonging means you're in a constant state of growth, right? And I'm rereading Bell Hooks' All About Love. And she uses this definition of love, which is that you have the willful extension of yourself towards the nurturance of another's growth or your growth. Yeah. And I'm like, I want love-based communities. And to me, that's what it looks like, is when you see that someone has fucked up or failed, that you're like, I'm going to willfully extend myself towards your growth so that there's room to come back. And now that doesn't mean people are ready for that, right? So I've definitely held space for people who were like, I am a flamethrower. You know, I'm in a flamethrower phase of my life and I'm just throwing flames at everything. And then it was like, okay, this community actually does need to set some clear boundaries, so that you know it's not okay for you to be burning down everybody's everything. And that's a particular move, right? That says you have a space here when you're ready to come back. And until you're ready to come back, we're having to set this boundary.
Right.
And again, there's no public shaming needed for that. There's no public humiliation. We don't get pleasure from that boundary setting. It's just a boundary that needs to be set.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that kind of cultural shift to me feels important.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, to try and talk about it without shaming it. I find like in relationship, I try to say, like, tell me if I fuck up, tell me, because that's a learning experience for me.
Yes, exactly.
And that's an opportunity for me to like hear your thoughts and know something else, and like also not do that again if I can avoid it.
Yeah.
That's surprising to so many people. Like, people don't expect that kind of, you know, you have to normalize that sort of.
Right. Because people don't even realize that this concept of perfectionism is one of the ways that capitalism plays out within us and within our community, that there could be some perfect, and that we can buy our way there or fake our way there, or, you know, Botox and plastic surgery are there or something. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, actually, no one is perfect. People are making mistakes all the time. And I love that how you said that, Scott, that like the mistake is the place where an aliveness becomes possible and a learning becomes possible. I also think there's something really important, like just that piece around boundaries, that I want boundaries from other people around me. Like, I want to know what the boundaries are that I need to uphold and honor, even if it hurts, you know, like,
yeah.
I think about that in my most intimate relationships when someone's like, no, Adrian, you can't cross this line. And I'm like, Me? You know, like, for real? And then I'm like, oh yeah, let me integrate that, because it actually isn't personal, right? That Don Miguel Ruiz shit, right? Don't take it personally. I'm like, when you stop taking it personally, you recognize like people's boundaries are about them taking care of themselves, and you can love them by upholding those boundaries. Even that is part of the learning. Like, I know a few people who have had been through big call-outs, and now they're sitting outside of a boundary, right? Outside of the community that they once felt so at home in. And they're like, it fucking sucks. And I'm holding the boundary and I'm learning what I need to learn out here in order to be able to make my return. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, like, even if I think there's other better ways to do it, fundamentally, what we're trying to do is develop a culture where we can set boundaries. The boundaries actually create growth and create space for actual authentic love to be possible.
It's actually funny. I always like thought about how the thing I like about hanging out with anarchists is that I can leave like any situation, and people like don't need an explanation for it. I'm just like,
right, exactly.
I'm done. You know, like
exactly.
With that sort of ability to like there's not the same kind of expectation to participate beyond your limits.
Because there's a practice of non-attachment. There's a practice of really being free around other free people.
Yeah.
Right? Which is very uncomfortable, actually, for people who are like, I mean, right now we're getting into the very, you know, to me, like, this is the, Ursula Gwynn wrote about this in The Dispossessed, just like what it means. This is why I really identify as an anarchist still. It's like that what it really means to be free is so at odds with how our culture is currently structured. We don't even realize all the ways we are weaving ourselves into a self-policed, self-controlled state. And that we're making all kinds of agreements. Control me, police me, correct me, control me. And I've just noticed this a bunch, like this past year, my visibility has gone up to a whole different level. And which means that a lot more people think that they should have control over me. Yeah. And really staying free within that context is like, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm glad I have developed the muscles before this visibility that I am free and that I deserve to be able to fuck up and make mistakes. And I can handle being in public as someone who's like, yeah, I fuck up. That's what I am, a human being. Yeah. Visibility doesn't make me less human or whatever, but it is a muscle that I'm like, I wish more people were thinking about even developing, much less practicing.
Yeah. And you model that in your, well, I mean, you have your podcast, but also like the book models that as a process, like the book, like We Will Not Cancel Us is presented not as a finished, like.
Yeah. It's a process. And like, you know, I made uncomfortable decisions in it. Like it would be much easier, I think, for me on some level to just pull down the original piece and be like, that's embarrassing. You know, like I made mistakes and there people can see them. But again, if I step outside of it and like don't think of it so personally, then it's like, well, I can imagine some young organizer being able to read the book and go back and see the piece and make the connection and actually be like, oh, like this was what you learned and this is what you improved. And like, you still have room to grow. Like this could be better. This could be sharper. This could be clearer. I'm like, great. You write the next book, you know, like keep this process going. And I really love, I recently got to be in conversation with Angela Davis, which was like wild because she's someone who I really looked up to. And like, but I really love how I've seen her handle critique in her life. You know, when people come to her and they're like, you know, why are you like this? Whatever. And she's like, yeah, exactly. Right. Like, yes, those questions, those are real questions that I'm in, that she keeps herself as like a living, breathing, growing being who is changing and learning all the time. And she's like, I'm not the same person I was when I was being pursued by the government, when I was arrested and all of that, when you campaigned to free Angela Davis. Now I'm this Angela Davis and I will continue to grow. And I'm like, that feels like a great model for those of us who hope to be elder organizers and elder activists and elder radicals. Is like, you know, Grace continued to be curious and grow. Angela continues to be curious and grow. And I want to be that, you know, like if I get the blessing of being old, I want to be that kind of elder.
Right. Yeah. And God, we need to have like that continuation, that intergenerational connection for, again, there's so many people coming in now with stuff that's happening. And just like, yeah, sharing our, our knowledge and experience and letting them, and then also getting theirs, you know, because they have a different perspective.
Exactly.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're listening to Scott's conversation with Adrienne Marie Brown about We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice, recently published through AK Press. More of Adrienne's writing can be found at adriennemariebrown.net.
So, like, you know, thinking, I've seen this tactic used when there's like a serial abuser in a community, someone who the community is like, we don't have faith of accountability from this person, and
yeah.
do like a general call, like flyering
yeah.
or whatever. And there's also like in science fiction, like,
yes,
you know, in like Woman on the Edge of Time, there's this idea that like, eventually, if you keep harming,
you're
going to get killed, right? Like,
I mean, Woman on the Edge of Time, you get one chance. Right? Yeah. Like you mess up one time, they give you the tattoo. And if you mess up again, that's it. They're like, we're not doing prisons. Right? Yeah.
But like, I mean, I've heard, you know, I have an organizer friend who says like part of abolition is like, is maybe the community decides that that's it for you. Right?
Yeah.
That's their vision of it.
Right.
I'm not saying that everyone needs to adopt that, but
but
there's like also revenge and stuff like that. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated because I will admit that I have one response is like, here's my theoretical, philosophical, you know, higher self response, which is like, we have to keep growing our capacity to hold even the most harmful people somehow. We have to figure it out.
Yeah.
But then the part of me that's like in communities regularly and has had to hold and set those boundaries and has seen that person, I'm like, you literally don't care. You must work for the feds. Like you are just like, you know, I don't know. Like when they were passing out like vibes of happiness and joy, like you missed the entire bucket. I don't know what happened, but like, right. Yeah. I've seen that side and I've definitely been in a place where I'm like, it has felt like there's no other option. There's no other option. Right. So I think what I mean inside of this is I'm like, I'm not actually judging, right, like what communities have to do to survive. And I don't think that any of us can do that for other communities. I do think for me, my questions, or at least I'm not trying to judge, you know, like I'm not trying to be like, oh, y'all are weak because you just like whatever. My thing is there's something around how we feel inside of it, right? So any of those times when I've had to finally be like, look, they're not willing to stop causing harm, we have to set this boundary. For me, it's been a move of grief. It's been a move of like grief and relief. And like, we just have to make this call and prayer, because I'm like, I know that us holding this does not mean that the harm is going to stop and they're going to go find someone else to hurt. And, you know, at an individual level, right, this is always a thing. It's like, if someone has been abusive to you, like, do you call the person that they start dating next, right? And be like, look, this person's going to fuck you up, right? Or do you just like, well, I hope it goes better for them. And people make different calls about that. And like, I think the things that help me through this, one is I do believe that people change. They may not change at the pace that we want them to, but I do believe that people change. I do believe that sometimes a hard boundary is the only way to get people to change. I've seen it happen before. I've seen it happen with people who had that positional power that they were abusing and abusing and abusing, and finally were like, you don't have it anymore. And that's when they actually were able to turn inward. So I do believe that the hard boundary sometimes can be the most powerful thing. You know, I do think it's difficult with the flyers and the revenge, like, you know, I've said it before. I'm like, that person just needs to get their ass kicked. Like they just, that's what needs to happen. Right. And I struggle inside of the same complexities, I think is the important piece here. What I want us to get good at as a community is feeling like we have as many options as we do actually have and practicing all of the options. And a lot of what my writing is in this time is like, let's not jump over all the options that could actually keep this person in our community or help this person to heal from the harm that clearly has happened to them or help this scenario, you know, play out differently. Let's not leap over all of that to have the very first thing we do say, plaster this person's face and name and like the intimate stories of the worst moment of their lives all over the internet and where anyone can see. To me, that's the move that I'm trying to keep us from, to be like, first, let's understand the history of this person. You know, what do we know? How do we protect the survivor from any further harm? Is the person actually open to mediation or to another process? If they are, who are the right people to hold that? Do we need multiple people to hold that? And so on and so forth, right? Now, there are definitely, I think that we need like boundary school. Like if I was like creating like some school that everyone in movement just had to go through for the next year, like we spent the pandemic and it's like, okay, we can't be out in the streets. Let's all go to boundary school. Let's all go to like abolition visioning school and figure out like when we say defund the police, what responsibility are we taking on in that scenario, right? Like I would have us just be in some real serious schools, right? I think Prentice Hemphill could run the boundary school. You know, I have visions on this stuff, right? I think Sindolo Diamania could like run the school on like abolitionist visions and like in practicing those at the local level. And Andrea Ritchie, I think, could do that. Like Mia Mingus, Miriam Kaba, like there's so many people. Like I think that there's a lot of learning and political education and practice education that we could do because there's pleasure in revenge. There's pleasure in being able to finally say this asshole is an asshole. There's pleasure in all of those things. But I think it's a temporary pleasure that doesn't actually change the conditions that will lead to more harm happening. I want us to start to get the pleasure mostly from healing and knowing that we have transformed the conditions and the harm will not happen anymore.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I'm like thinking of like this sort of glorifying of like a phenomenal like violence that like cleanses things that... But then you get like, I'm going back to Butler because we're talking, like, you know, she explores violence in terms of community and where it belongs, but she holds it in complexity. She doesn't endorse it. And she shows the detriments to it. And
And I mean, I think there's something fascinating, right? Like in one of my favorite explorations that she has, which is The Wild Seed, Mind of My Mind, which are two books inside the Patternist series. There's this character named Doro who is a straight up body snatcher. And I remember doing a series of reading groups around this where I was like, you know, eventually a whole huge interconnected network has to take him out because he just will not stop causing harm. And he literally can't. He can't survive if he stops causing harm. But I was sitting in one of the reading groups one time and someone turned to me and they were like, did she ever try to heal him? Like the lead character is one of the most amazing, outstanding healers that has ever existed. And the person said, did she try to heal him? And I went back and read the book and I was like, I don't really see it. Like she tried to argue. She tried to demand. She tried to shame. She tried to run away. She tried a million things to hold him accountable and to ask for him to change. But there's not really a moment where it's like she laid her hands on him the way she did with others and reached into that place where he was a child whose entire family had been killed. And this was the strategy that emerged for him to survive. And I always come back to that. And it moves me to tears each time that I'm like, if we look at each person who's causing harm as a child who has been harmed, it changes the conversation. And I think it could change what's possible. And I don't, again,
Welcome back to CKUT on 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah Jesmer. You were just listening to a February 14th conversation with author and activist Adrienne Marie Brown with North Carolina-based Final Straw Radio. If you want to hear the rest or learn more, go to thefinalstrawradio.libsyn.com. And as always, some news that you can use. The Afro LGBTQ Arts Festival Masamadi is rolling their 13th edition virtually right now until March 12th. There's film screening, stand-up comedy, art therapy workshops, and you can find out more at masamadi.ca. That's M-A-S-S-I-M-A-D-I. And the city is experiencing a rise in overdose-related deaths, according to advocates and officials. A 2017 Quebec program made way for people to pick up free naloxone kits at pharmacies. Naloxone counters the effects of some opioids. That pharmacy program still applies now. Kits can be picked up for free at any provincial pharmacy, ideally with a health card. And that's it for us today on this Friday's episode of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The team includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Grace Kobold, and me, Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything that you've heard tonight, or if you want to participate, be part of this, or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department by sending an email at newsintern@ckut.ca. Again, that's newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, connect with us on Facebook. Search Off the Hour or CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next. We'll see you next week.
Sur les ondes de CKUT 93 FM à l'émission Café, votre émission hebdomadaire d'art et culture. Ce soir, on reçoit Catherine Alexandre Briand, fondatrice du projet Connexion et l'éditrice du recueil Interconnecté. Un recueil qui se questionne sur la connexion. Qu'est-ce que se sentir connecté à soi, aux autres ou à l'environnement? Et comment ce sentiment nous affecte-t-il? Sur Catherine Alexandre, on peut lire que s'il y a une chose qu'elle aime